If we could begin. I have some time constraints. We have to be finished by 11:25, so I've got 45 minutes. So that's not a lot of time to talk about something that's truly deep in my heart. I mean, I'm sure I can grab another 5 minutes here and there. Yeah, okay. I'm TSA pre-check, so I can get through a little quicker, I hope. And I don't know how busy the SeaTac is during the on Sundays. How many people want to leave Seattle? A lot. It's interesting, you know, Seattle. I mean, I haven't been in downtown Seattle for a very long time, but I had friends who lived here, and I spent time here. And it's a great city, an absolutely great city. I'm a prairie boy, used to cold sun or hot sun, and I would find it so hard to live with clouds. But yeah. So I mean the warmth, you know, and the fact that it's raining and not snowing, I love 40 below with sun out more than I like rain. As I get older, that might be less true. But anyway. Okay. I hope I've conveyed my own feeling that the Big Book doesn't require a lot of time out of your life. It just requires commitment and concentration. You know, step 11 evening prayer is 5 minutes. The step 11 morning prayer and meditation is 5 minutes, maybe 10 if you've got a really complex day ahead of you. And then saying, I'm no longer on the show, I'm no longer running the show, I'm no longer running the show is like half a minute. You know, so it's not as if you're devoting your whole life to prayer and meditation. As a matter of fact, the Big Book says very clearly, page 88, this is not all. There is action and more action, and prayer is clearly not action from the Big Book perspective. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. And this is the step where, in my humble but pretty experienced opinion, OA falls down on. And so I want to spend time on this and ask you to think very clearly about how OA and you, if you've recovered, carry the message of recovery. And I mean, I remember when I was first in OA in 1986, our literature was the Big Book and the AA 12 and 12 and the stories in the Overage Anonymous, and some pamphlets. But I remember, and so we had more of a Big Book approach or 12 and 12 approach from AA. But I still remember when we would read in the chapter Working with Others, the paragraph of your telephone may jangle at any hours, you may be called to the hospital, you may have to administer medications, and you know, there's a whole list of things that you have to be ready to do. And I remember sharing on that and saying, oh yeah, but that's what AAers do. We have the telephone. And you know, that was part of me in OA in 1986, how much worse it is now when the tools of recovery are considered to be worthy of meetings. Whereas the tools of recovery are just there to help you work the steps. Sometimes people will say, I was upset, so I did a tool. And my question is, if you're upset, why didn't you do step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9? Or step 11? I mean, you know, the steps are the answer. We are a fellowship of the 12 steps, not a fellowship of the tools, not a fellowship of love and understanding. We're a fellowship that exists I said this already, a direct result of the step 12 need to carry the message, because this isn't 11 12th measures help you, it don't help. You have to do all 12 steps, and the 12th step is having had a spiritual awakening as the guarantee, we Big Book thumpers say the, or sometimes say the, result of these steps, having had a spiritual awakening as the guaranteed result of these steps, we tried to carry this message. What is this message? The message that we have recovered through the 12 steps, message recovery, to compulsive eaters, overeaters, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. How do we carry the message? How well do we carry it? This is something that we must constantly rethink. How am I doing today? And we should be open to different methods of working the steps and open to different methods of talking with people and continually reworking our story so that it resonates with those who still suffer. They don't have to come to us. We have to go to them. I was at an OA World Service Business Conference in, I think it was 1995 in Houston, or it might have been 1996 in St. Louis, when the Board of Trustees presented a slideshow. They had those in those days, not PowerPoint, but a slideshow showing how our membership declined half in at that time. It was really declining. And the best thing about World Service Business Conference is not the business, but it's the meetings that you go to, the OA meetings you go to. Night, morning, evening, noon, lunch, supper. And there was a 10 o'clock meeting. I remember that meeting. I remember where I was sitting at that meeting because it was a very dramatic meeting. It was right after this presentation and OA is in trouble. We have to figure out what we're doing. And it was in one of the large conference rooms, but it was dark. It was on a high floor because I remember the windows you could see outside. But everything was dark except the sort of the one small area where there was there were chairs in a circle and we were sharing at 10 o'clock at night. And I remember one woman is in tears. I need OA. What am I going to do without OA? We're in terrible shape. And people went around the room, and it got to a guy who says, I'm in AA as well as OA. And every so often in AA, we have these concerns about, AA is going to die. He said, my sponsor said to me, as long as there's going to be some guy sleeping under a bridge, there's someone else who's going to go up to that guy and say, I once was just like you, but I'm not like you anymore. And the reality of the situation is that whether OA exists or not, I need to carry the message to those who still suffer. And OA deserves to exist only as long as it's a proper messenger of the big book. So long as it's a proper messenger of the 12 steps. Please forgive me. I don't mean that. You don't have to be a proper messenger of the big book. You have to be a proper messenger of recovery through the 12 steps. Ooh. Sigmund Freud, where are you when I need you? So I really believe that we have a duty to make OA as good a messenger of the steps as we can. And there are a lot of things. I've been involved in a bunch of different roles in OA over the years and visited so many different intergroups doing workshops and stuff that I have my own perspective. I'm not sure it's accurate. So I want to share it with you. But it all comes down to me to recovery and joy in recovery and a sense of, and that comes down to me as well with a sense that there's a simplicity to this program that we sometimes make very complex. Now, we make it complex for a number of different reasons. First of all, life seems to be more complex, and it is in many ways. Navigating through life seemed to be simpler in the old days, although really when you look at it, it was simpler for a lot of people, but just as difficult for a lot of other people. We just didn't know them, But it seemed to be simpler, and life, and we've read so many books, self-help books, and we've read so many interpretations of the steps, and we've read so many things that we mix other ideas into the simplicity of the program. Simple but not easy. That's what the big book says in Bill's story. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. To me, the simple message, and the message that allows me to feel absolutely the same as all those people who are in my opinion, my spiritual superiors, but at least my mentors in this program, who don't always use the big book, who have not all used the big book, or use parts of the big book, but use parts of other stuff, who often will sponsor using OA literature only and not OA approved literature, which includes a lot of AA literature like the big book, and they're so spiritual, they're so wonderful, and I have very good friends who are like this, and what we have in common is certainly not the big book. We have in common the steps, different interpretation of the steps even, a different way of doing them. But I think what we have in common is that it was for us life or death. We recognize how serious this addiction is. And that's hard sometimes because it's not dramatic. And we don't have, I mean, we do have dramatic examples, the 800 pounders and all that, but for the most part, the idea that an alcoholic, once he takes or she takes that first little nip of whiskey, will be on a bender right away is something that's enshrined in movies and television. It's something that we may have seen in our own lives, but who has ever said to us, oh, you know, that first bite of the cookie will send you on the bender that will render you unconscious, or you may die 3 days under a bridge, you know, 3 days under a bridge because of alcohol poisoning, or, you know what I'm saying. It's just not dramatic. And we're not dramatic people, and we're not, you know, what the Big Book says, the alcoholic is an unlovely, the alcoholic in his cups is unlovely. Well, we certainly all, I don't know about you, I always felt unlovely. But not dramatic. And if my friend Wally hadn't told me I should take my food as seriously as he took his alcohol, as I told you, I would have weighed another 100 pounds before my doctor, my wife, would have said, you got to do something because you're going to get diabetes. And even then, you know, I have people, I know very close people to me who have diabetes and weigh 150 pounds too much and still overeat, and still their solution is just to inject themselves with insulin, you know. And how do we convey the seriousness? How do you convey your seriousness? So what we have in common is it's life or death. We got abstinent as honestly as we could, and we worked the steps. And we carry the message as if our lives depended on it. I mean, it's really that simple for me, because I think that's what we all have in common. I know that when the newcomer will come into a lot of the rooms in OA, they will not be met with someone who will say, this is life and death. I used to be like you. Here's my story that proves that I used to be like you. I worked the steps. I got abstinent. I figured out what I can't eat. It may be different from you, but I figured out what I can't eat, indulge in. I worked the steps and now I don't want them. And that's a miracle to me. And please let me help you, because it'll keep me alive if I do. You're doing me a favor. I think they're often met with, welcome to Overeaters Anonymous. Here you will find love and understanding beyond your wildest dreams. We understand what it's like for you. We're spiritually and emotionally so much better, and the physical will take care of itself in time. Keep coming back. It works if you work it and bring a lot of love. I mean, love is not in the Big Book. You know, you don't have to love your fellow compulsive eaters. And I understand how important it is for people who've been isolated and victimized, or who feel self-pity, whether earned as victims would, or not earned as I was. So I was full of self-pity. I didn't even deserve to be full of self-pity. I was full of it. I understand how wonderful it is to come to a place where you're accepted as you are, as you look, you know, and to be hugged and to be loved. I not only do I understand it, I would not deny anyone of that experience. At the same time, we often kill people with that. And one of my mentors in this program quoted someone, he doesn't know where he got it from, but it's, honesty without compassion is cruel, but compassion without honesty can kill.
Say that again.
Honesty without compassion is cruel. Compassion without honesty can kill. And if that, the shyest woman in the room hadn't told me over 25 years ago, in the kindest, nicest, but most direct way, that I was really screwed up, that I really should take a look at myself, that, I mean, she didn't say it. She just said, how are you really? But behind all that was, what the hell are you doing talking so much about the steps when you clearly aren't following them? That's what she was saying to me. She was saying it in the nicest possible way, but I that's what I heard. And she was absolutely right. How good a shape are you in really? And I was in terrible, terrible shape. But I was talking about how wonderful this program was. And I was killing people with that. because newcomers would come in the room and see this person that everyone looked up to. At least they told me they looked up to me. I was so articulate. I knew the big book well. I knew the history of AA well. And I was talking with so much authority. And yet I was completely undermining the reality. I was completely undermining the message I was trying to give by my appearance and by the fact that I really wasn't working the steps. And I got to tell you, the whole thing about keep coming back, I understand why people say it. If you're not there when the message is to be heard, you won't hear the message. It would have been so much better for OA and for me if I had taken umbrage at what my friend said to me if I had left the program. Because then I would have come back with my tail between my knees. If that's the right phrase. You know what I'm saying?
Legs.
Legs, yeah. Whatever it is. Yeah, my knees between my knees. Anyway. It's been a long weekend. So the big book's approach to carrying the message is a little bit tougher. And I venture to think that most people in AA who are also in this program would say that their experience in AA is tougher. It's much more direct. There's a Clancy tells this wonderful story. He's kicked out of the last hostel in Los Angeles. He, the ex-University of Texas professor, he has this one little thing. He's kicked out by some bouncer someplace. He says, as I was flying through the air, he says, my 8 years of psychoanalysis stood me in great help because I was able to analyze this person's emotional character. He was angry. Anyway, he's hungry. He's got no place to live. His front teeth have been knocked out. He's got no job. He's got nothing. He goes to an AA club room to get a coffee and donuts. And he tells a story. He's a much better storyteller than I am. He's amazing. And so he's eating a donut, drinking some coffee, and a guy comes up. I'm your sponsor. I'm Bob. Oh, hi, Bob. Read the book. Meaning, obviously, the big book. Oh, I'd like to, Bob, but I don't have a place to read it in. Read the book. I don't have a job. I have no place to live. I have no food. Read the book. You know, they're like, oh, okay, Bob. You know, and he tells a story. I mean, I have a friend, a woman friend who's in AA and OA, and she says that her sponsor has given her the role of protecting the 20-year-old women from the 40-year-old men who come up and say, I'm your sponsor. So life is not golden in AA either, apparently. And I don't think I'd ever come up to someone and say, I'm your sponsor, you know, read the book. But that directness at any rate is very funny. You gotta hear his talks. He's just hilarious. But I just wanted to read to you from some AA literature. On the genesis of the chapter working with others. First of all, the last major talks that Dr. Bob and Bill gave. This is Dr. Bob's in Detroit in 1948. You can get a recording of this online from, I think it's xa-speakers.org. A lot of historical talks, and he says this. I used to go to the hospital and stand there in my mind, the spirit of service was of prime importance, but I found that it had to be backed up with some knowledge on our subject. I used to go to the hospital and stand there and talk. I talked many a time to a chap in the bed for 5 or 6 hours. I don't know how he ever stood me for 5 or 6 hours, but he did. We must have hidden his clothes. I don't know how you... Anyway... Anyway, it came to me that I probably didn't know too much about what I was saying. We are stewards, guardians of what we have, and that includes our time. I was not giving a good account of my stewardship, my guardianship of time, when it took me 6 hours to say something to this man that I could have said in an hour if I had known what I was talking about. And I take that seriously, and I give a challenge to people. I think it would be great for an intergroup to do this. Get 10 long-time recovered people. Tell them that this is their assignment, that they're going to be meeting on stage with a person who's going to pretend to be a newcomer. And the newcomer is going to say, Boy, that was a great meeting. Thank you so much. It was just wonderful. But you know, I just want to know more about sort of OA. And, I got to catch a bus in 5 minutes. And ask these long-timers to prepare a five-minute talk. What would they say? I think we could learn so much from the way they tell their stories. I can certainly do that. I mean, I've worked very hard at, I can do a 3 minute, I can almost do a 1 minute, but I can do a 3 minute, 5 minute, and of course I can do a 15 hour, talk. But each has his or her own stories. I mean, I can tell my stories of the goose and the, you know, the hand coming and the vomiting in the diner. But people here have much better stories, I'm sure, than I do. It certainly is, they're better in the sense that it's their story. And the big book gives us directions for how to tell our story in a way that someone will listen to. And they're very good. Dr. Bob also says this. He says, I said I was quite human. I get to thinking every once in a while that this guy Bob is rather a smart individual. He's got this liquor situation right by the tail, proved it and demonstrated it, hasn't had a drink for over 13 years, probably could knock off a couple and no one would be the wiser. And at this point in the recording, you can hear people laugh. He says, I tell you, I'm not trying to be funny. These thoughts actually do enter my mind. And the minute they do, I know exactly what has happened. You see, in Akron, we have the extreme good fortune to have a very nice setup at St. Thomas Hospital. The ward theoretically accommodates 7 alcoholics. The good Sister Ignatius sees that it's stretched a little bit. She usually has 2 or more others parked around somewhere. Just as soon as that idea that I could probably polish off a couple enters my mind, I think, I love the way these guys talk. Uh-oh, how about the boys in the ward? You've been giving them the semi-brush-off for the last few days. You better get back in the job, big boy, before you get into trouble. And I patter right back, and I'm much more attentive than I had been before I got the funny idea. But I do get it every once in a while. I'm sorry, but I'm not going to be answering any questions. I can't. I'm running out of time. But I do get it every once in a while. I'll probably go on getting it whenever I get careless about seeing the boys in the ward. Anytime I neglected them, I was thinking more of Bob than I was the ward. I wasn't being especially loving. Those fellows had come there indicating their desire for help, and I was just a little too busy to give them much of my time, as if they had been panhandling on the street. Don't want to be bothered with the fellow? 10 cents to get rid of them? That's easy. You could even stand 2 bits. Not because you love the fellow, but just to be relieved of the nuisance of his hanging on your coat sleeve. No unselfishness, no love at all indicated in that transaction. I think the kind of service that really counts is giving of yourself, and that almost invariably requires effort and time. It isn't a matter of just putting a little quiet money in the dish. That's needed. But it isn't giving much for the average individual in days like these when most people get along fairly well. I don't believe that type of giving would ever keep anyone sober. But giving of our own effort and strength and time is quite a different matter. And I think that is what Bill learned in New York, and I didn't learn in Akron until we met. Now let's go back to Bill. I don't have time to read you the various passages from the big book and from Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age. But Bill tells his story in a number of different places, and they're all very powerful. His story, remember, Ebby speaks to him. He goes to the town's hospital. He has this sudden spiritual experience. Dr. Silkworth says to him, whatever has happened to you is better than what you were. You know, keep it. For 6 months after that, he tries to carry this spiritual experience to any drunk he can find. He picks them out of New York. He goes to the church where Dr. Shoemaker and Ebby were. He takes them home. He and Lois agrees that they will do this as an investment. Lois cooks and does the laundry and cleans out the ashtrays and works at her job at Macy's. And Bill talks and talks and talks and talks and talks. And these guys stay with him. And there were 2 guys. One of them did 2 of the following 3 things I'm going to tell you about. One guy commits suicide in the house. One guy steals Lois's fur coat. And one guy, and that's obviously one of those 2 guys, attacks Lois with a butcher knife. And yet they still keep on doing it for 6 months. And then according to Lois, and it's not found in her book, Lois Remembers, but I heard it from Joan Charlie talked to Lois, and I also heard it from a friend of mine in OA who just passed away, who had talked to Lois. Lois was talking to, and I can't find it in the literature, but I'm, it's probably there. Bill was saying to Lois after about 6 months, I don't know what to do. I haven't been able to keep one alcoholic sober. And Lois says, yes, you have. You are. And that was the beginning of Bill's realization, and later on he speaks to Dr. Silkworth as well, of Bill's realization that carrying the message, no matter the consequences, no matter whether anyone heard the message, was necessary. I mean, obviously it was there. You help others without hope of property, prestige, or reward, but this is different. And he began to realize that his need to carry the message was more significant than whether anyone heard the message. And then he was talking to Dr. Silkworth, and he was saying, I just can't carry this message. And Silkworth gave him, and Bill talks about it in two different parts. One is in three talks to medical societies, and the other is in AA Comes of Age. He quotes Dr. Silkworth slightly differently, but to the same effect. Just a little background before I talk about Dr. Silkworth said, remember that Bill offers Ebby a drink, and Ebby says, I'm not drinking, and Bill says, come, what's all this about, I queried, and Ebby says, I've got religion. And he proceeds to explain about the Oxford groups and this Protestant group that was trying to bring the passion of Christ back to Protestantism. And Bill rejects it, and he talks about he doesn't believe in God, and I believe in the devil because he sure has me now. And then Ebby says, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And that strikes Bill, and Bill says that it was only willingness that was needed. I don't have to believe in anything. I just have to be willing to work these things that Ebby's telling me about, and something will come to me. So Dr. Silkworth said, And remember that Bill knew Ebby's story cold. Ebby didn't have to tell his story to Bill because Bill and he had been best friends and they had gotten on huge drunks together. And Bill had often said, if I ever get as bad as Ebby, I'll have to stop drinking. So the appearance of Ebby sober and not wanting to drink this glass that Bill hands to him is a miracle to Bill because Bill already knows Ebby's story. But none of the people Bill spoke to knew Bill's story. And Bill was evidently preaching at them and talking about this sudden experience of the mountaintop and the cold wind of God coming through him and saying, you got to have this. And Dr. Silkworth said, that's not going to work. You're preaching at them. You're speaking to them from on high, and they think you're crazy. Why don't you drill into them the hopelessness that you had? That I talked to you about, the double whammy of not able to stop once I've started and not able to stop from starting. Because that's what will really give them the despair that they need. And that you had at the moment that Ebby walked through the door and you knew you were doomed. And, I'll make a joke in a moment. Bill finds himself in Akron, Ohio. It's a stock battle, and the investors that he had stood to make a lot of money if they had taken over the company, a mechanical company that made parts for rubber manufacturing facilities. And Akron was the sort of the center of rubber manufacturing. And Bill finds himself in Akron, and he's abandoned because they lose the battle. And Bill is asked to stay there for a little while to check to see if there's any fraud in the voting. And he's in the Mayflower Hotel, and the violins begin to play. Evidently, if you go to the Mayflower Hotel now, not on Founders Day, June the 12th, where there's tours, but on another day, and it's a senior citizen's home, and you press a buzzer, and someone told me that a voice says yes. And you say, well, and come on in. And the buzzer sounds, and you're let in the door, and some very tired person says, this is where the phone booth used to be. This is where the bar used to be. This is, you know. Because, of course, it's Mecca, right? I mean, it is sort of like, and I'd love to go to Akron. I've never been to Akron. Anyway, he's in the Mayflower Hotel, and he tells a story in a number of different ways, but he knows he's about to drink. He's lonely. It's Saturday, May the 11th. He's lonely. He's depressed. He's got hardly any money left. And suddenly he realizes he needs to find another alcoholic to talk to, or else he will drink again. And this desperation leads him to a number of phone calls where he says to people, I'm a member of the Oxford, I'm an alcoholic member of the Oxford groups. I need to find another alcoholic to talk to. And he finally finds one person through the intercession of, he finds a person who says, who gives him a list of names. He finds a minister who gives him a list of names. And the last name that he wants to call, because it's Cyberling, and Mr. Cyberling he had met, who ran the Goodyear Tire Company, he had met his wife, and he thought this was Mr. Cyberling's wife, and he didn't want to call, but finally he did, Henrietta Cyberling. And she turned out to be the estranged daughter-in-law of Mr. Cyberling. She was living in the gatehouse of the Cyberling estate. Not much of a gatehouse, it was a beautiful house, you can see pictures of it online. And she invites him over. She had been a member of the Oxford groups for the year and a half that the Oxford groups had been in Akron, Ohio. And into the Oxford groups came Dr. Bob Smith and his wife, Anne. Everyone loved Dr. Bob. Everyone adored Anne. And he was a hopeless alcoholic, although he didn't think anyone knew it. And they followed the Oxford group precepts, but Dr. Bob would never admit he was an alcoholic. Henrietta, I get this, there's a recording of her telling the story. Henrietta engineered a special confession meeting where everyone was in on it except Dr. Bob, where everyone confessed their darkest secrets. And he finally confessed he was an alcoholic. They prayed over him and they worked with him and he continued to drink. So Henrietta says, I think I have just the right person for you. I know, I'm not an alcoholic, but I know one. And she arranges a meeting, and Dr. Bob and Bill both speak about this meeting in their various stories. Dr. Bob extracts a comment, a promise from Anne. We're doing it for Henry, Henrietta Henry. I'm not going to spend more than 15 minutes with this man. Well, they came at 5, they left at 11. And Bill starts to tell his story. And Bill tells his story, and AA comes of age, and he, for the first time, he focuses on what Dr. Silkworth told him to focus on, this double whammy of the allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind, or the phenomenon of craving and the mind that keeps sending you back. And this is what how Bill describes it in AA Comes of Age. In our first conversation, I bore down heavily on the medical hopelessness of Dr. Bob's case, freely using Dr. Silkworth's words describing the alcoholic's dilemma, the obsession plus allergy theme. Though Bob was a doctor, this was news to him, bad news. Always better versed in spiritual matters than I, Bill had been a member of the Oxford groups for 6 months, Dr. Bob for a year and a half, and was a devout man, and Bill had never been a devout man. Always better versed in spiritual matters than I, he had paid little attention to that aspect of my story, even though those were all the stories that he would tell to these guys in the first 6 months. Even though he couldn't make them work, he already knew what the spiritual answers were, the steps. What really did hit him hard was the medical business, the verdict of inevitable annihilation, and the fact that I was an alcoholic and knew what I was talking about from personal experience made the blow a shattering one. In Dr. Bob's story, is afterwards written for the AA book, and years later in his last full-length talk in Detroit, he made this point very clear. It was not any spiritual teaching of mine. Rather, it was those twin ogres of madness and death, the allergy plus the obsession, that triggered him into a new life. It was Dr. Silkworth's idea, confirmed by William James, who wrote about religious experience that have to come at the depth when you're that often come at the depths of despair, that struck him at great depth. And then he says this, you see, our talk was a completely mutual thing. I had quit preaching. I knew that I needed this alcoholic as much as he needed me. This was it. This mutual give and take is at the very heart of all of AA's 12-step work today. This was how to carry the message. The final missing link was located right there. Oh, I'm running out of time. My first talk with Dr. Bob. Okay. I'm going to go briefly through the instructions in the big book. The first, I point out on page 89, the promises. Life will take on a new meaning, to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship group up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. The next few pages are how to find the person, because this book was written for people who didn't have AA in their hometown. And the one thing that I want to that I want to point your attention to is on page 90, at the bottom of the middle paragraph. If the person you're looking to is interested in talking to you, his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. Okay, page 90. There's a middle paragraph there. Sometimes it's wise. The last six lines. If he says yes, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. Do you see it?
Yeah.
Okay. You should be described to him as one of a fellowship who is part of their own recovery. Try to help others. And who will be glad to talk to him if he cares to see you. On page 91, there's the description, the beginning of the description of the first visit. Right in the middle, see your man alone if possible. The instructions in here are very clear. You tell your story in such a way that he or she begins to relate and he or she begins to understand the double whammy, this allergy, this phenomenon of craving and the obsession of the mind. You can read that for yourself, but you'll see how it works. On page 93, they say, if finally he's interested and asks you how you did it, tell him everything. Stress the spiritual aspect of the program. That's the time you talk about the spiritual aspect. Before, you're just asking him to understand how you were in despair. Never brand him as an alcoholic. Brand yourself as the alcoholic and let him draw his own conclusions. And let him feel despair and ask you how you got out of what you, of being what he was like, or he or she, he was like in this book. I just wanted to, before I go on, quote to you from Bill in a talk to medical societies, where he talks about, we aim to produce a crisis. We aim to show them how, if they're like us, they're gonna die. They've got this vicious circle of not being able to start once you've stopped. Not being able to stop once you've started and not being able to stop from starting. And then he says this reduces him to a state of complete dependence on whoever or whatever can stop his drinking. He becomes, and I love these words, sweetly reasonable, truly open-minded, as only the dying can be. And that's sort of the ideas that the Big Book has about doing it. And then on page 93, they talk about the spiritual aspect, and they give a couple of really significant words. If you're agnostic or atheist, you don't have to agree with your conception of God, that you'd be willing to believe in a power greater than yourself, and that you live by spiritual principles. But if you speak to a person, and if you're going to deal with such a person, don't use specific language. Don't use religious language. Don't arouse any prejudice he may have against certain theological terms and conceptions. Don't raise such issues no matter what your own convictions are. So if you happen to belong to a very specific religious denomination, don't assume that the person you're speaking to shares that. I can't tell you, but there have been a number of people who have come up to me and thanked me for talking about atheism and agnosticism in OA. So many people in this program hear the word God and hear people talk about God in such a way that it makes it so difficult for them to enter into the idea that it's your own conception of God. And so, please, those of you who are religious who talk about God, listen to your words carefully and see whether or not you're putting off any people rather than encouraging them to come in. But it has to come from your heart. And then they say, well, you may speak, belong to a religious denomination. He may know more about religion than you do. And then the Big Book says, yeah, you probably know more about it, you do, but right at the bottom, page 93, call to his attention the fact that however deep his faith and knowledge, he couldn't have applied it or he wouldn't drink. That's pretty tough talk. You know, and, you know, for all the wonderful parts that Dr. Bob talks about giving service, Sister Ignatia in a talk said, Dr. Bob would often come to her and say, kick this guy out. He just wants a free lunch. He's not interested in working the steps. So there's a toughness here that you don't always find. Page 94. It is important for him to realize that your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you are helping him. I'm so thankful to be able to carry that. You can't know how thankful I am that you have invited me to come here. You really can't know. It's given me so much more strength and so much more passion. Anyway, you tell them about the program, and then you leave. It's an hour and a half, 2 hours. That's, you leave. It's up to that person to say, I'm ready. You don't push them around. You don't say, you got to do it. They have to come to you. And page 96, don't keep chasing a person who cannot or will not work with you. Because you're wasting your time. Let them find the depths of despair and come back. So you see this whole codependence stuff that we often find in OA is not in AA. You want it, it's there for you, the asking. I'll give it to you, I'll spend whatever time you want. But you have to want it. And if you don't want it, I've got other people who do want it. But boy, you want it, I'll do whatever I can to help you. Now the second visit, right in the middle of page 96, he's read this volume, say he's prepared to go through the 12 steps of the program. Having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. You don't control him. You give him advice. Tell him, let him know you're available if he wishes to make a decision, step 3, and tell his story, step 5, but don't insist upon it if he prefers to do it with someone else. Do you give him a place to stay? Only if he doesn't ask for it, in a sense. You know, I mean, it's sort of like if he asks for it, don't do it. That's like that, like Clarence and Bob, the sponsor. But helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. And then right at the bottom, page 97, for the type of alcoholic who's able and willing to get well, little, on page 98 now, little charity in the ordinary sense of the world is needed or wanted. The men who cry for money and shelter before conquering alcohol are on the wrong track. And I just want to go on. I mean, there are all kinds of ifs and buts there, but they say, the next paragraph, it is not, page 98, it is not the matter of giving that is in question, but when and how to give. Can I have a little bit more time? Okay. The minute we put our work on a service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. Consider the sponsors, kinds of sponsors that we find in this program and see whether, and in AA too, because I've been told that they exist in AA. Do what I say. Here's how to do it. Rather than, and then, to whom are you now dependent? On the sponsor or on God? Some of us have taken nonsense. That's the shortest sentence in the big book. Some of us has taken very hard, he clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. Nonsense. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. You know, phone me at 6 a.m. If you phone me at 6:01, you aren't committed. You know what? I'm not sure that's helpful. I'm not sure. You know, phone me every day and answer a whole bunch of questions. Well, I know that there are a lot of programs that work well doing that. A lot of ways of doing the steps that work well. But let me give you a few suggestions as to how to judge whether it's working well or not. First of all, at a meeting, are there people who do sponsor but have no time to sponsor? And is there anyone there to sponsor, or is everyone too busy sponsoring? And are the sponsors spending time with people who have already recovered rather than with people who haven't recovered? Have they got such a relationship with their sponsees that they don't have time to help the newcomer or the people who are still suffering in the rooms because they're talking on the phone or meeting with people who have already qualified to sponsor, ready to carry the message to others? So they're keeping themselves so busy, but are they really carrying the message to those who still suffer? Now, in many parts of this world, there are people who work the steps completely, work the steps very differently, have very structured way of doing it, have, you know, a whole bunch of ways of doing it, and it works for them. And as long as in their meetings there are people available to sponsor for those who still suffer, I don't care how they work it. It works for them. That's terrific. It doesn't have to be the big book way. As I say, it doesn't, you know, I'm not suggesting there's only one way of doing it. But think about it and just sort of analyze what you're doing, what your sponsor's doing, what, how you sponsor in relation to, are you making yourself available to those who still suffer? Is your method of working the steps harming or helping carrying the message to those who still suffer? I'm not suggesting that any other method is bad, but I'm suggesting that flexibility and lack of dependence upon the sponsor is the key to the OA, to the big book way of doing it. Lots of promises on pages 100 to 103. Page 102 is your job description. Your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. Look at your meetings. Do they make it uncomfortable to prattle on and to whine? Do you have a job to do in your meetings to carry the message of to those who still suffer of the 12 steps? Or are you, and I was responsible for a meeting of this kind, having a meeting in which people can just whine and whine and whine? Because if your meeting allows whining, it doesn't provide for carrying the message of recovery through the 12 steps to those, recovery from compulsive eating through the 12 steps to those who still suffer.
What do you do when that happens?
You call a, what do you do when you see a meeting like that? You do a step 10 on them, or a step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, and you figure out what the proper response is.
You don't just
The proper response is after you have taken away your selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear from the equation by working steps 4 through 9, you will know what you should be doing. It may be you just leave the meeting and let it die on its own. It may be you ask for a business meeting to be called. And maybe you just go there and talk to every single newcomer who comes and say, you know, they sponsor in this way, I sponsor in this way. I don't know what it is because it depends on the meeting. And it depends on who you are and how you yourself function. There is no right answer to that question, but the right answer will come to you if you do steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And I try to be so flexible because I don't know the answer for you. The amends that I might make for a situation might not be the amends that you should be making for the situation if you were free from selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. Okay, I am running late and I do have a plane to catch too. So I'm going to go back to the provocations, to make sure that I've covered them all. I think I have. Not recovering, I think I've done that to death. Abstinence is not the most important thing in my life without exception. The consciousness of the presence of God is. As long as I'm conscious of the presence of my higher power, I want to be abstinent. I am revulsed by the idea of eating the things that I've given up. Although a sponsor, if available, is very important for recovery, a sponsor is not necessary to recover. You know what? You don't need a sponsor. If you can't find the sponsor you want, the directions are right in the big book for working them. You have the 12-step workbook that allows you another way of doing the steps. You don't need a sponsor. It's helpful to have one, but it's your responsibility to work the steps, no one else's. And if you want to get better, work the steps. If you don't, live in misery. That's your decision, not mine. And I can despair for you. I can love you. I can feel bad for you, but I can't lift you out. The only way to get out of the hole you've dug is to stop digging. Right? You reach your bottom when you stop digging. You can recover in weeks. I hope I've shown you how easy, it's not easy. It's simple. Very simple steps. Not a lot of thinking, but some thinking to go through. And how step 4 is probably the longest step. It could be done in a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And then 5, 6, 7, 8, bang, within days. And then maybe you go to 9. And how quickly do you have to get to 3? Well, it depends on how despairing you are and how hopeful you are. And I say it doesn't depend on whether you have followed a particular script. How quickly you read, how well you read, how much you retain from the big book or other writings, if you've been in the program for 20 years and you've relapsed and you're just feeling awful and you're crying and you're in terrible, terrible shape, if I were sponsoring you, I would say, do you understand the phenomenon of craving? Do you have a good plan of eating? Let's work out a plan of eating with you. Do you have some hope that if you work the steps, it's good, you're going to find a power greater than yourself? Yes. Let's say the step three prayer and get you on to step four. Why delay? Why force a person to continue to be on his or her knees and dangle step four ahead of them? Because that's when the recovery begins. That's when the action begins. Step three is a decision. Step four is carrying through with the decision. Okay. The tools of recovery are not an essential part of the program. The tools of recovery are there to help you be abstinent while you're working the steps. That's what they're there for. And there are some people in this program who will not stop until those nine tools become 12. But they are not the program. And that's clear. We're a 12-step fellowship. You don't take steps two and three, one and two. I hope I've shown you that they're just acknowledgement steps. Steps three, six, seven, and eight shouldn't take a long time to get through. I've discussed that. You don't make amends to yourself. I've discussed that. You shouldn't sponsor until after you've completed step nine. You can be of great service and you can help people. I mean, there are meetings where no one has recovered. So what do? You help each other. You buddy each other. You work the steps together. That's what I did. I worked the steps with someone who had not recovered and I hadn't recovered. So both of us worked together as if our lives depended on it. And we both recovered. Service is not slimming. I am proof of that fact. When I was in relapse, I was very active in all the service positions. And I hadn't recovered. You can keep busy. But it ain't slimming unless you work the steps. Food can be discussed at meetings. The Big Book says, in our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. How can I tell my goose story without talking about goose? You know, there was a piece of poultry sitting on a cutting board. Well, maybe that's getting too close, you know. And there was some epidermis on it that contained, you know. I mean, really. You know, there's a wonderful speaker in OA, Bob, who talks about being at a meeting where some, where you couldn't mention food, where someone said, and I had three white drops of something, or three white balls of something. And he said, for the rest of that meeting, he was trying to figure out what the heck she was talking about. And he talked to two other people who were at them, and they all had different ideas of what it was she was talking about. And they went up to her and said, what were you talking about? She had, and it was the fourth one. And he was spending all this time thinking about what the heck she was talking about instead of listening to the message. You know what? We're a safe haven, but safe havens can be taken to such an extent that I can't tell my story. If I can't tell my story, it's ridiculous. Because that's what my meeting is there for us to tell our stories. How can you identify with someone who can't tell a story about how he eats? Every person who wants to be a member of OA should know exactly what having a desire to stop eating compulsively means. Yeah, that's what qualifies you for membership. But what does it mean? Does it mean you want to lose weight? No. It means that you agree that you have an addiction of the kind that Overeaters Anonymous has the answer for. That's what it means. And if our meetings don't carry the message that that's what it means, then people come to our meetings for the love and the comfort and say, well, I have a desire to stop eating compulsively, when in fact all they have a desire for is comfort and love and the ability to be around people who might give them some support. But we're not a support group. We give support, but we give support to people who work the 12 steps. We don't just give support. You can join TOPS, a non-profit organization. They no longer use the oinking pig. It's a very good organization for people. No, it is. A very good organization for people who just need support. And many people only need support. They need a good diet and support. And a weekly weigh-in. And if that's what works, a non-profit organization, fine. But we're the last house on the block for people who are addicts. And who need something like the 12 steps to give them relief from their addiction. And we shouldn't forget that. Okay. There's always more to say, and I haven't said it. But I want to finish with a thank you, and I thanked you already. And I've got to tell you, I was given gifts that go far beyond what I am given and what I think I deserve. But I am very thankful for you for that. Thankful for you for having me. I'm going to tell you a story, and then I am going to read from the Big Book. It's an AA story. A speaker comes, standing ovation, people lined up. You have overwhelmed me with your wisdom.
Don't thank me, thank the big book. Thank God.
Your explanation of step nine just was a revelation to me. Thank you.
Don't thank me, thank God.
And a long timer comes up to him and says, that was a really good talk.
Don't thank me, thank God.
And the long timer looks at him and says, you weren't that good. So I've been blessed with a great education and a lot of training in textual analysis and teaching and all that. So it's not easy for me to do this, but it does come off relatively easily. That has nothing to do with me. I am one bite away from relapse. I'm one bite away from going back to be the fat glutton that I have been. And if I weren't able to carry this message, I would be there. So I want to thank you very much. Okay, page 164, last few paragraphs. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation, which you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. You know, you can see steps 4 and 5 and 8 and 9. Give freely what you find and join us. 12. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge. Don't let anyone tell you that trudge means anything other than walk with a weary step. It doesn't mean walk sprightly or, you know, with great vigor. It means walk with a weary step. We got a long haul ahead of us.
Purpose.
You know, Clancy says, he calls alcoholics pukes. He says, we spend so much time with the pukes outside of us, so we spend no time with the puke inside of us. And that's what we got to do. We got to dedicate ourselves to carrying the message. You will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you till then. Thank you very much.
Thank you.